Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Okay, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. John Bacon. He is a dental anesthesiologist practicing in the Washington, D.C. area. John, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a great podcast and I've been enjoying all the episodes.
Yeah, this is great. We've had several kind of anesthesia topics recently, and one in particular, I was talking with Joe Funderburk about some allergic reaction cases he had, and that was a good discussion, but we thought we'd build off of that and have you talk to us a little bit about anaphylaxis. But before we do that, can you kind of give us a brief history of your training and your current practice setup?
Sure. So I graduated dental school in 2011, went into a pediatric dental residency, then practiced peds for 2 years, and then returned to a dental anesthesia residency for 3 years. And then I did kind of a mix between academics at Howard University Dental School and private practice at an ambulatory surgery center for roughly the past 5 or 6 years.
Awesome. That is fantastic. Do you like living in the DC area?
I do. I like the four seasons. So, you know, it keeps things fresh, I think.
That's awesome. We just took our kids there a couple of weeks ago for their spring break, first time there.
Oh, excellent.
The cherry blossoms were in bloom. That was pretty to see. Usually for our vacations, we go to Florida and sit on the beach. And so I got to tell you, our kids did a lot of complaining about the museums and the walking. And they just need to become more cultured. You know, I need to do a better job as the father. That's how I felt after that trip.
I think after every vacation, I think I need to do a better job as a father.
Exactly. All right. Well, good. Can you start us on this topic and talk to us a little bit about just what anaphylaxis is and how we deal with it?
Absolutely. So I think that the reason why I like this topic is because it's not cut and dry. So there's a ton of nuance to discuss. I think kind of in medical school, dental school, we're taught like in like the PALS mode where it's this kid in a picnic setting and he gets stung by a bee or he eats some peanut butter and then go, what are you going to do? But I think in our world, it's a lot more kind of frog in water heating up, and you kind of, it's not usually that like very classic clinical presentation. And I kind of want to talk about some of those clinical presentations because I think once you've diagnosed anaphylaxis, it's not quite as hard, but getting to that diagnosis, especially when you're under anesthesia, is a difficult trick. It really is. And it's not always super easy.
Got it. Okay.
Regarding, you know, statistics, I think just some statistics that are important. The lifetime risk of anaphylaxis is roughly 1-5% for any person. And then the two statistics that I think are really glaring, this a lot of it comes from ED literature, is that 57% of anaphylactic episodes are not recognized. And then 50-80% of anaphylactic episodes do not receive epinephrine. So that tells me two things. It tells me there's a failure to recognize, one, and then there's a failure to administer the life-saving drug epinephrine. So hopefully we can kind of get to the bottom of that today. And that's not like a something that's just for parents. It's healthcare providers as well. So we as a whole in healthcare are not necessarily recognizing when we need to recognize. Under anesthesia, the incidence of anaphylaxis in pediatrics has been quoted about 1 in 35,000. In adults, it's higher, 1 in 15,000. And I think that at some point, we're going to see this in our careers. And so I think it's something that's always good to talk about.
For sure. Yeah, this is a great topic. And I like some of these stats. You'll probably get to this, but as far as like what, you know, are the main causes and signs and symptoms, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So I always like to kind of starting with like signs and symptoms. I always like to start with kind of a case. And this is my daughter. So my daughter, when she was 8 months old, she had some peanut butter for the first time and she went to the bathroom and next thing we know, she was vomiting. So, okay. I mean, you well know you have kids and they vomit all the time. So, you know, me and my wife are thinking absolutely nothing of this. And then about 15 minutes later, she develops like kind of a flushing on her face and on her neck, but she's playing, she's comfortable and she's happy. And there's kind of no other signs or symptoms. So I always liked it. So what we did is we gave Benadryl, right? And within, you know, I would say 20 minutes, the rash resolved and she was totally fine. Great. So I give this lecture to residents about anaphylaxis and I always ask, well, who would give Benadryl in this situation? And, you know, all the hands would go up. And then I say, okay, well, who would give epinephrine in this situation? And none of the hands usually go up. And the key takeaway here, and we'll talk about it, is this was anaphylaxis. And if we did have an EpiPen, epinephrine would have been warranted in this situation. Now, you may be thinking, well, this isn't anaphylaxis because the child improved after the Benadryl, right? But remember that antihistamines are going to take 30 to 60 minutes to begin working, and steroids are going to take hours to begin working. So they're not nearly strong enough to overcome this profound mast cell dump that anaphylaxis is. So my daughter improved because she improved, because her endogenous catecholamines took over, and luckily she had a mild reaction. We were lucky in that sense. So if you talk to some allergists about this, so I have a good friend, Dr. Nassim Reedy, who's an allergist, a pediatric allergist. And I said, okay, tell me in your words, why would you administer Epi to this child? And she agreed that was warranted. And she said, well, there's a few things. One is that with a kid that can't communicate, you may be missing important symptoms, such as a scratchy throat, itching, that the child can't communicate. Which to me, my first thought came to, well, that's very similar to anesthesia, right? Like we have a patient that can't necessarily tell us any symptoms. We're just going off signs. And then two, and I think this is also crucial, is you never know the course of that anaphylactic event. It doesn't necessarily progress linearly. It could be looking very good and very mild. And then within 3 to 4 minutes could kind of turn into something very severe. So that risk to benefit ratio is always in the favor of that IM epi. And I just want the audience to kind of take that away, because that's something that I certainly didn't know in dental school and certainly in residency. And I wasn't freaking out during this situation. So I think it's important to talk about.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I like that. And how, like you're saying, different patients, it's almost like a spectrum and they can have a different amount of a dump of that reaction and start going quicker or slower. And I think we all have this textbook image of, you know, taking seconds and their throat swelling up and it's all very clear, but there is such a range there.
Yeah. In talking to allergists too, I think it's interesting because we're always kind of taught in anesthesia that it's kind of anaphylaxis is a binary switch, right? It's either full blown anaphylaxis or it's not. But interestingly, if you think about like the way that they deal with kids with allergies, especially food allergies, they do like test dosing, right? So they incrementally work it up. So it is actually, anaphylaxis is actually dose dependent. But the catch and the caveat is that everybody's sensitivity threshold for anaphylaxis is different. So while it may take, say, 5 milligrams of peanut in one kid to induce anaphylaxis, they may work it up from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then that triggers anaphylaxis. In the next kid, it may take twice the dose or something different. So I think that that's kind of interesting in the sense that it is dose dependent, but when we're in the anesthesia realm, we're giving doses that are probably so far in excess of that threshold for anaphylaxis because we're giving it IV and we're giving usually pretty whopping doses at a time. So I think that in our world, we've probably eclipsed that threshold substantially.
As far as age and this reaction, I mean, is there any correlation with like the younger you are, the more like dump of histamine you have, or the more pronounced thing, and the older you get, the less, or the more events you have, the more stronger they are, anything like that?
So in the literature, you will see that, for instance, food allergy is a lot more common in children, but luckily it's not usually fatal in younger children. The fatalities for at least food allergy come in actually the teenage years, the 10 to 30 year old range. So those are the ones you kind of have to watch for food allergy. And we'll talk more about when it comes to drug allergy, kind of when we're in the perioperative setting, that's typically more your older patients, your 60 year old patients. Patients that would be in your chair as an oral surgeon. And the reason why is because they have been exposed over a lifetime to more drugs, right? So this would make sense. They've had time to sensitize and they can have these IgE mediated reactions. So I think another thing that's really sticky about anaphylaxis is defining anaphylaxis, right? Like everybody, if you were to ask a group of residents, how would you define anaphylaxis? Well, it's a systemic life-threatening emergency. Yeah. Okay. But there's about 23 different world organizations that define anaphylaxis, and they all define it very differently. So how are we as clinicians or parents supposed to kind of tease through this if there's so many different definitions? So I like this new proposal definition by the World Allergy Organization. So I'm kind of a keep it simple, stupid type. I think it makes it a little bit easier. So I'll kind of go into that. So you can have anaphylaxis in one of two ways. One is your first stipulation is you have to have skin or mucosal involvement. So mucocutaneous signs and symptoms, that would be hives, pruritus, something like that. And then you add it to a second system. So the second system is going to be respiratory, cardiovascular, or GI. So respiratory is going to be dyspnea, wheeze, hypoxemia, hypotension, typically we'll define as less than 90 in an adult, less than 70 plus two times the age in a kid. And then GI symptoms would be your severe abdominal pain or repeated vomiting. So with my daughter, she had the skin signs, right? Which actually the skin signs came second and she had the vomiting first. So that would be your two system involvement and that would clear you for having the diagnosis of anaphylaxis. So that is kind of what's classically taught. Another way that you can have anaphylaxis is if you have an allergen and then you have no skin symptoms, and then you have hypotension, bronchospasm, or laryngeal involvement. So the takeaway is that you can have isolated hypotension with absolutely nothing else, and that can be a clinical diagnosis of anaphylaxis. And I think that's super important to take away because when we look at the perioperative literature, you will see that hypotension is going to be the first and most common thing you're going to see with these patients. And you may not have any of these signs in the skin. So, and as an addition to that, in all anaphylaxis, when we look at all anaphylaxis, one in five patients do not have any skin signs throughout the entire episode. So I think that if there's one thing the audience can take away from today is we're always taught, you know, I remember in anesthesia residency, you know, okay, blood pressure gets soft. If you can, and the drapes are accessible, expose the chest, look and see if you see that hives in the urticaria. But I think that that's a faulty way to come about this. I think that that is not necessary because what it'll do is it'll tunnel vision you in the wrong direction away from anaphylaxis when it very well could be anaphylaxis, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. Another great point you're bringing up here it's kind of scary too. The hypotension is the main first thing. And oftentimes there aren't hives. It makes us feel better to think that we would have a visual cue.
I mean, you know, you get in that situation where the blood pressure gets a little soft, the first reading, well, I just pushed a little bit of prop maybe they're sensitive to the fentanyl that I gave. So that's not probably the first thing on our mind. And I do just want to kind of make sure that everybody is getting a little bit more accustomed to thinking, look for that hypotension. That can be the only thing that's the tip off to this thing.
And I would think if you had rapid hypotension, probably you're seeing a rapid pulse to compensate.
Correct. And that's a great point. And so that when we talk about the triad of anaphylaxis, we talk about, and this is from the NAP6 data from Britain, is you see hypotension, number one, most common, bronchospasm, number two, and then third is the tachycardia. So in the initial signs and symptoms, it is not any skin that we're seeing perioperatively. That is a lot lower on the initial presentation. And I think that's an important takeaway. And then I think that there's just important to bring up too, is that we used to talk about anaphylactoid reactions. So those are non-IG mediated reactions. So an example of an anaphylactoid reaction would be like a Redman syndrome with vancomycin, a IV contrast media, which those can be pretty wicked. And then maybe like fentanyl. So it's just that it's causing the mast cell to degranulate, but it doesn't need sensitization before. Whereas the classic anaphylaxis is the IG mediated form. So what I just want to get at is that we're no longer kind of using the vernacular of anaphylactoid. It's all under the umbrella of anaphylaxis. And actually that makes a ton of sense, right? Because our problem is a mast cell and basophil dump of vasoactive mediators. It doesn't matter how we get there. And clinically we treat it the same. So we might as well just call it all one thing. That's just something I kind of want to get at. So I think the tough thing about anaphylaxis, it is a clinical diagnosis. There is no metric, there's no assay that is going to help you in the moment. It's just your subjective judgment of what's in front of you. And I think that's super difficult, especially when you have this slower and maybe more insidious onset. And it's not like this PAL scenario where everything all at once, oh, it was a bee sting. That's super easy. Now, afterwards, after the event, sure, there are some things that can help you out. So for your residents out there, tryptase testing is what you're going to want to do 1 to 2 hours following the event. And your tryptase levels are going to spike 1 to 2 hours afterwards. You also may want to pull because you're not usually expecting an anaphylactic event. So you may want to pull a tryptase sample 24 hours later and after the event. And that'll give you a baseline to compare to the 1 to 2 hours after the event. And then skin testing is another thing. Skin testing, you have to wait 4 to 6 weeks afterwards. And the reason why is you need to let those mast cells build up their stores again. So 4 to 6 weeks after the event, you can send your patient for skin testing. If you send them earlier, you're going to get a false negative. Now, also what's interesting is that allergy testing will not find a definitive allergen in 40% of patients. So I think that, you know, a common myth is that it's usually understood what's the triggering agent. And I think that in our setting, a lot of times we still don't know. It's always this kind of nebulous. There could be a lot of things. And I think a takeaway for a lot of clinicians is once somebody enters your oral surgery office, I would consider them exposed, right? Especially if they're receiving an anesthetic, right? Because as soon as you get that IV going, you're pushing some propofol, ketamine, midazolam, local anesthetic with metabisulfite, all of these things. Although, yeah, you know, you hear in the literature that midazolam, ketamine are very low likelihood of triggering anaphylaxis, but anything from Surgicel, gel foam, Tylenol, NSAIDs, all of these things have been shown. Sevoflurane, everything has been shown to induce anaphylaxis. So I would say once someone enters our office, consider them having an exposure to an allergen.
This is a really good point. Yeah, I like that a lot. As far as a patient, and I'm sure getting to this, but that is under anesthesia and starts developing hypotension, you're probably working into this as far as treatment, but where do you go with that and how quickly do you act on that?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, all dependent on setting, you know, did you just push something that could have bottomed them a little bit like a propofol or something? But I would say, generally speaking, if you're seeing some hypotension, you're unclear, you can definitely consider low dose epi. And we'll get into that kind of at the end, though, like when we talk about IM epi versus IV epi, because I think there's a whole discussion to be had on that. When I mean low dose, if you're going IV, there's a lot of downside to IV and a lot of danger with it, especially if you're not used to pushing IV epi, but you want to start like quite low at like 0.1 mics per kilo. So, you know, a 70 kilogram patient, push 5, see how it goes, push 5 and work your way up. So I think like you kind of asked about like triggers and stuff, so we can get into that. So when we talk about triggers of anaphylaxis, we talk about three main categories. We talk about drugs. So this is what we're dealing with in the perioperative setting, venom stings, and then food allergies. And I think it's important to touch on those, even though like we're not necessarily dealing with like venom stings, but just to kind of have a broader scope of what's going on. So drugs are the most common. They cause 75% of anaphylactic deaths in the US. So that's your big hitter. And obviously that's the one we worry about the most. There are risk factors for anaphylaxis induced by drugs. So these risk factors include patient factors. So the patient factors are older age, like we talked about, because you're going to be more prone to expose to multiple drugs and sensitized. And then also another patient factor is African-American race. When we talk about comorbidities, cardiovascular disease is a big one, and also asthma. So cardiovascular disease makes a lot of sense when you're having a cardiovascular insult and anaphylaxis and you're already kind of weak in that department, you're going to be more prone to morbidity and mortality. And then asthma. So asthma is a big player in all parts of anaphylaxis. It's always a risk factor. So whenever you see a patient on, you know, your schedule or a kid with asthma, atopy, eczema, these are all big indicators of kind of things you should be more concerned with, because if they do have an anaphylactic reaction, it is typically going to be more severe with them. Some other comorbidities include emphysema. Obesity is starting to come up in the literature a lot. From a medical standpoint, medication standpoint, you have beta blockers. Beta blockers make a lot of sense because you're blocking that ability for epinephrine to potentially hit its target sites. And then interestingly, any antihypertensive. So even your ACEs and ARBs have been shown to kind of mess with your ability for epi to potentially treat an anaphylactic episode. Not sure if we're kind of fully up on that mechanism yet. Drugs associated with anaphylaxis and mortality in the perioperative setting. This is something that the residents certainly need to know. Neuromuscular blockers are always number one at about 60%, followed by latex 20%, and antibiotics about 13%. Other perioperative triggers that aren't necessarily talked about a ton are chlorhexidine, something that's really important because you guys are probably using that in your offices a lot. Colloids, blue dyes, radio contrast. And then actually NSAIDs are another big one. And the statistics aren't fully out on those, but they are commonly cited in the literature as inducing anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis for neuromuscular blockers and antibiotics is going to occur pretty quick. And that would make a lot of sense because they're being pushed on induction. Whereas latex and chlorhexidine, especially like a chlorhexidine prep, are going to need to be absorbed through the skin. So those are, you're typically not seeing this anaphylaxis start occurring until about 30 or so minutes into the case. For neuromuscular blockers is kind of a 1-2 between succinylcholine and rocuronium. I would say that the majority of literature points to succ being number one, causing about a third of anaphylactic reactions to neuromuscular blockers. Roc is probably a close second, but because Sagamidex was invented, we're now using a lot more Roc. We're going away from succ. So rocuronium is essentially rising a little bit above succinylcholine in the literature. And then the last category is antibiotics, which again account for about 13% of our perioperative anaphylactic reactions. And of those, the big players, not surprisingly, is penicillin and cephalosporins. So they account for about 70% of our anaphylactic episodes. This is something that's always kind of brought up because previously we said that if you had anaphylactic reaction to penicillin, you wanted to avoid cephalosporins. But recently that's kind of been deemed too conservative because of antibiotic resistance, which is rising. And actually the rate of cross-reactivity with penicillin allergy and cephalosporins is very low. So it's like 1%. So, and also after about 10 years, they found that 90% of patients that definitively had true anaphylaxis to penicillin have lost that IG-mediated reaction. So we're kind of going towards like a delabeling in a lot of hospitals, which I think is excellent. Hopefully will make our jobs a little easier. But the takeaway is that if you had anaphylaxis to penicillin, yes, you can use a cephalosporin that does not contain the same R1 side chain. And if there's show notes, I could kind of put some of these graphics in there. But takeaway, because I know that cefazolin is used a ton, cefazolin does not contain the same R1 side chain as a penicillin base. So you're okay to use that in any type of situation, even if they had anaphylaxis to penicillin.
One quick question is the route of administration and how that affects anaphylaxis. So if you were to give a patient PO antibiotics, a couple pills, like 30 minutes before the procedure versus pushing an IV, is the degree of anaphylaxis going to be any different, or is it just going to happen more slowly with the pill form?
That's a great question. Based on the literature, I would say that. So that's more of like what we'd see in a food allergy. So if you look at the three categories of things that can trigger, it's drugs. Number one, drugs IV form are going to hit in about 5 minutes. You're probably going to start seeing that anaphylaxis. Venom stings typically 15 minutes on average. And then anything food or orally ingested is going to be about 30 minutes before you typically see that. So if you were to give that anaphylactic antibiotic up front, you'd probably be expecting to see that anaphylactic episode in about 30 minutes. I don't think that it would be any less severe, but I do think it would be a slower onset. So maybe you could be recognized before it kind of got too bad.
Got it. Okay.
But, you know, I always said on the flip side of that, right, that insidious kind of where it's slowly getting worse and worse is also difficult to diagnose, right? Because it's like, when do we pull the trigger? When is that actually something we're worried about? So that's kind of a flip side to that.
Yeah. I think I mentioned this on the other podcast, but I had a friend, you know, who pushes routinely ANSUF, cefazolin for his patients, and had that patient have anaphylaxis to it. And it wasn't immediate. It was like, even after he had left the room after the procedure, while she was recovering in post-op, then it just kicked in all of a sudden, and it was like very strong reaction, you know, airway swelled up and pretty scary stuff.
That is.
For us as surgeons, I think there's a bunch of messages there, but one is being careful, you know, as far as what we are giving them and how necessary is it. And then knowing that it might not always be so immediate, and always keeping an eye on them, make sure they're not sitting in post-op recovery with nobody watching them, all that type of stuff.
And I think that's why this topic is so like wild, in the sense that, like, yes, the average after pushing IV is probably 5 minutes, but that range of variability, even in the IV form, I mean, people can take 45 minutes, who knows, you know, it just really depends on the individual. So it's just the vigilance it needs to be there. And then also, I love the concept of like, the more I practice, like the keep it simple, stupid, less drugs. So you know what can be a trigger instead of the polypharmacy sometimes.
Yep. Good point.
When you talk about food anaphylaxis, that's another thing I think is important to talk about. Again, we kind of touched on young age. So infants and toddlers have the highest rates, but they're rarely fatal. Teenagers do have the highest rates of fatality to food anaphylaxis. Previous allergy is another one. So actually, with food allergies, that's the weird one, where we always think that if somebody has an anaphylactic reaction, the next time it's going to get worse and they're going to die. Well, that's not necessarily true with drug anaphylaxis or with venom anaphylaxis. With food anaphylaxis, it is. So if you have a mild reaction to a food at time A, at time B, it is likely to be worse and very severe. And that is not true of the other types of anaphylaxis. The other thing with a food allergy is it's very, very highly correlated with asthma. So about 75% of patients with food allergy are asthmatics. Regarding food anaphylaxis triggers, so there's 8 foods that account for 90% of food allergies. And it's in this order. You have milk, egg, soy, wheat, shellfish, fish, peanuts, and tree nuts. Interestingly, cow's milk is the most deadly of those, which I don't think that a lot of people would think. I think we'd kind of go in our heads to a tree nut type situation, but just something to be aware of. Oh, the other thing that always comes up is, can we use propofol with, say, an egg allergy or a soybean allergy, right? So remember that propofol contains 2 things that are important. It contains soybean oil, and that's where there's a concern, and then the egg lecithin. So soybean oil is devoid of proteins. So since it's devoid of protein, it's non-allergenic. And then the egg lecithin is a fat derived from the egg yolk. And so since it's a fat, it doesn't contain the proteins, so you're okay on that. So the major immunogenic portion of eggs is ovomucoid protein, which is from the egg whites, and that is not in propofol. So takeaway is, you're typically safe to use propofol if there's a previous allergy to egg or soybean. I've used it on, I've never had an issue with a previous allergy to egg or soybean when pushing propofol.
Got it. That's good to know.
So should we jump into kind of what we're looking for from a clinical presentation? Because I think this is kind of huge here. So again, this is a great study. It's called the NAP6. It's from British Journal of Anesthesia in 2018. And they have 2 great graphics on this. Is one is, what is happening at the initial presentation? So what are the doctors actually picking up on when they notice anesthesia or notice anaphylaxis? And then kind of throughout the course of the anaphylaxis, what other things become apparent from a clinical manifestation standpoint? So again, this flushing and urticaria. So flushing was only seen in 8% of patients initially. Urticaria was only seen in 3% of patients initially. So I think that we should kind of try to separate our minds from necessarily looking for those things to tip us off to anaphylaxis. If they have those, great. It makes the diagnosis a heck of a lot easier. But very often you're not going to have those. So don't necessarily be looking for those, or it might clue you in the wrong direction. So again, hypotension was present in 45% of people initially. In 20%, they picked up bronchospasm initially. And then in 12%, it was tachycardia initially. Now, over the course of the anaphylactic event, hypotension was present 95% of the time, which makes sense. Bronchospasm 50% of the time, tachycardia 52% of the time. And then flushing becomes present by the end of the episode. So at 55% of cases had flushing at some point during the course of the episode. But I think the key is that it's not necessarily initially present. So we should try to separate our minds from that when we're looking for, is this possibly anaphylaxis? So I think one takeaway is, you know, if you ask the question, can you have isolated hypotension with no other signs and symptoms? Yes. And that can be anaphylaxis. Another thing that is not necessarily talked about a ton in the literature is angioedema, right? You can see that as a clinical sign. And then pulmonary edema. And pulmonary edema is something that's in the literature. It's not often talked about, but you may wonder, well, why pulmonary edema? Well, because it's a distributive shock, right? We're third spacing, we're losing intravascular fluid into the interstitium. And if it happens to go in the toe, we don't care about it. But if it happens to go in the lungs, it's certainly going to kind of ruin our day. And then another thing why pulmonary edema is a little bit more common probably is because what's the treatment for anaphylaxis is massive fluid resuscitation. So you have massive fluid resuscitation, you have leaky pipes, maybe you have a little bit of epi, which could also contribute to that. So they have had isolated cases of anaphylaxis where it's just pulmonary edema as the only thing that they're seeing on the ground. So that's kind of interesting. Differential diagnosis. So I think the one thing that might come up a lot in the office space or under anesthesia is, you know, if you have this bronchospasm, is this just an exacerbation of COPD, of asthma, something of that nature? How do we kind of tease that out? Obviously, timing plays a role in here. So if you're dealing with intubating a patient and you throw if you intubate the patient and then they have the bronchospasm, that's probably not, it could be anaphylaxis from the induction drugs, or it could just be a reaction to that tube, right? But most of the stuff that you guys are doing is open airway stuff. So if you have a bronchospasm in the presence of hypotension, it's 27 times more likely to be an anaphylactic episode. So again, I keep going back to the hypotension, because if you have a bronchospasm and it's just a bronchospasm with a COPDer, they're probably going to be maybe tachycardic, maybe a little bit hypertensive. But if you have bronchospasm and hypotension, that's a tip off. Also, bronchospasm and desaturation is 20 times more likely to be anaphylaxis. So just some things to look out for.
So if it is this usual hypotension you see first, probably, you know, we're not so sure that it is anaphylaxis. We're treating it with, you know, the various medications we have to lift the blood pressure up. And then, I mean, usually is hypotension progressing to involving these other symptoms, the angioedema and things like that? And what point do the scales tip and you're like, okay, this for sure is going to need an epi injection?
Yeah, I think that is the most difficult question to answer. And I think that a lot of times you may not see anything else like we're talking about, and maybe just isolated hypotension. Hopefully you'll have something else to tip you off. But I think that there's always a role for the baby epi in this situation. So if you go with that 0.1 mics per kilo or 5 to 10 mics in an adult, if you're seeing that hypotension, you do have to act. And if you're going to pick a drug of choice, especially in an office-based setting, I would go with epi, because that's the one, if it is anaphylaxis, it's going to treat that symptom. If you're, you know, I doubt that any of us are, you know, pushing vasopressin or levofed or anything like that in the office-based setting, in oral surgery office. So I think that there is a role for epi, but very, very low dose IV.
That's a good point. And then, I mean, everything that goes along with, you probably get to this too, but just with pushing epi and kind of the support you need after you push that.
Yeah. So I think that's a perfect segue to get into the treatment. Okay. So again, it's not always easy to diagnose, but once we diagnose, we kind of have to have an on-off switch to where we are now treating this as though it is anaphylaxis. And the mainstays of that treatment are discontinue the allergen, remove whatever allergen you think may be causing it. You probably want to DC the anesthetic, right? Because that's going to be vasodilatory in and of itself. Call for help. You want to administer 100% oxygen. And then you want to assess that airway, because if there's impending airway closure, that's something you're going to have to deal with along with managing the cardiovascular system. And that's what makes this emergency so difficult in a office-based setting, where you guys have an open airway, the airway is not secure, and now you're dealing with blood pressure on top of securing an airway, and you may not have a ton of help. So consider an advanced airway. In some cases from literature, they'll have like a patient with a very, very large tongue swelling. But if you can get past that tongue swelling and throw in an LMA, you may not have the subglottic swelling. The other thing that's an interesting thing that comes up in the literature and case reports is, especially like you said, that you had that one case that you were talking about where it was happened in post-op, right? And the patient's sitting there in post-op. Remember that supine positioning is everything. So there was a few cases in the literature of patients that came into the ED. They were suspected, of anaphylaxis, but they did have anaphylaxis, and it was usually in teenagers, and they were sitting in triage. And when they were called back to the treatment room upon standing, the blood just bottomed out because they had no vascular tone, and these patients arrested right there, and they were not able to revive them. So very, very important. To if you think you're having any allergy situation in the PACU or in your recovery unit, make sure that patient is supine. And if you can do a passive leg raise, that's always warranted. Something that I think a lot of us, like, that would not be the first thing to come to mind, especially in a patient that's theoretically still able to talk to you, and then to be able to bottom out like that is pretty impressive. Now, that may be because these teenagers are a little bit more vagal tone. So maybe that wouldn't happen as readily in more of an adult patient. But as oral surgeons, treating a ton of these third molars in this patient population. So
that's a good point, because in oral surgery, I feel like as soon as we're done with the procedure and we're recovering, it's like the mindset is tip the patient up, sit them up, more for airway, right? To open the airway.
Exactly. If we talk about, get into the drugs here. So two drugs, and let's kind of throw a lot of the other drugs by the wayside. So two drugs is epi, and the other one is fluids. Now, if you want to talk about steroids, H1 and H2 blockers, those are great. Those are wonderful, but they are not saving that patient anytime soon. So I think that, especially when your hair is on fire and you have an emergency like this, it's easy to keep the algorithm simple. And if we just think epi and fluids, that's what we need to keep in our mind. The steroids are not helping you for 5 hours down the line. There's no evidence to say that they are not going to help or not going to hurt you. They're not going to hurt you, but they're certainly not going to help you. Same thing with H1 and H2 blockers. So they're great, and I would do them, but only once you've very much remedied and rectified the situation.
What about ephedrine, phenylephrine, those type of medications?
I don't think that they play a huge role here when we talk about patients that are refractory to epi. This is like 10% of patients do not respond to epi in anaphylaxis. It's quite rare. But in those patients, you're probably reaching for more of like, you could reach for like Levofed, or probably better yet, vasopressin. But hopefully, by the time that you're getting into that situation, this patient is already transported to the ED and you have a lot of help on your hands to manage. And then I think another thing that always comes up is, well, what are the contraindications to, epi if you have a patient that has, say, a stent in place? Or what about that crazy patient that comes into the ED with a STEMI and now they have anaphylaxis, or a pregnant patient? Can they receive epi? And I just want to make very clear that there are no contraindications to epi in any patient if they're having anaphylaxis, because the anaphylaxis is going to kill them. So you want to make sure that, sure, do you need to have a little bit more deft hand with somebody that's having a STEMI? Sure. And I wouldn't want that patient in front of me. But if you don't treat the anaphylaxis, you have a whole nother can of worms on your hand.
And what about in the situation where you've given too much epi? How do you recover from that? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think that obviously you don't want to get yourself into that situation. I think that that is a lot more likely to happen if you're giving IV epi, but probably the waiting it out is the best thing to do. I don't think that, certainly you could get into like using nitroglycerin to kind of vasodilate, but then you're kind of bouncing around that yin and yang. Probably wouldn't be reaching for nitro unless I had like a STEMI in front of me.
Would you use labetalol or anything like that? Or
yeah, I think that would be warranted. Certainly kind of any metric, as long as, or maybe, probably better yet, like an Esmolol, something that's quicker acting, so you can help titrate that a little bit better, knowing that like if you did give IV epi, it's going to be off in probably three plus minutes. So you'd want to kind of have something that's shorter acting. And then from the ED literature, there's one syndrome that I just want to touch on, which is called Kunis syndrome, which is when it's essentially it's cardiac anaphylaxis. And what's happening there is that the dump of the mast cells and basophils, all these vasoactive mediators, are causing coronary vasospasm, which is either causing the STEMI, or that vasospasm is throwing the thrombus, which is causing the STEMI. So again, not anything that we can kind of help or take care of, but something just to be aware of. So regarding kind of treatment, I think that let's break down, because epi is the mainstay, right? So let's break down treatment into IM, and then we can talk a little bit more about IV. So for IM, just to make it simple, you have junior EpiPen, 150 mics. That's for children 0 to 5. And that can include infants. So it's okay to give an infant 150 mics as long as you're giving it intramuscularly, vastus anterolateral thigh, and you want to give it in the vastus lateralis because it has expedited systemic uptake and superior blood flow. So there is good literature to support. Do not give it in the deltoid. You want to be giving this one in the thigh. So children 0 to 5 is 150 mics or your junior EpiPen, children 6 to 12, 300 mics or your adult EpiPen. And nowadays we're calling for 500 mics for teenagers and adults. And I think that that kind of breaks things down about as simple as you can. And I think that the key is you probably want to overshoot rather than undershoot in the IM form. So don't be afraid if you have a very young kid or you know, you have a small 10-year-old and you only have the adult EpiPen, give them the adult EpiPen. So 90% of patients will respond favorably following the first dose of IM epi. If not, you want to re-inject Q5 minutes, and 98% will respond favorably following the second or third dose. So your chances are pretty good that this is going to work if you do it properly IM. Now, I think that the tough thing is when we start talking about how do we do IV epi, because with IM epi, it's very much it's a binary. You have diagnosed anaphylaxis and it doesn't really matter the severity, right? You are going to give that IM dose, and that makes it easy. That's back to like the keep it simple, stupid. But when you start talking about IV epi, this is where it gets incredibly complicated, because you're essentially titrating your dose of IV epi to the severity of that reaction in front of you. So it's a constantly moving target that you have to do. A few things to keep in mind. And, you know, I talked to my friend, Chad McCarthy. He's an ED doc in California. If you talk to the emergency physicians, I think that they are very reticent to use IV epi. So if you talk to them, most of them, I think, will tell you that even if it's a severe anaphylaxis in the ED, they're going to use IM epi first round. They're going to use IM epi second round. And only if that second round does not work, then they will switch to an IV form, a titrated infusion of epi. And when you ask them why, it's because there's a lot of consequences. So you're a lot more likely to overdose an IV form. So what could happen? They've seen STEMIs, strokes, myocardial infarction, ventricular arrhythmias, pulmonary edema, and mortality. So I think that if we are reaching for that IV epi, we have to be careful to do it very slow doses at a time. And then also something for us in like the ambulatory setting is, how many times have we popped open epi in the past 5 years, right? I would say that most of us, hopefully, have not, right? So it may be more prone to medication error if we're pushing IV, just due to the nature that we are not doing this on a daily basis. So are there upsides to IV epi? Yes. Superior speed of onset, superior titration. And I think that the anesthesiologists are more likely to push IV. It's like a lot more comfortable. But if you talk to ED docs, they're going to be a lot more comfortable with IM. Now, again, there's quoted stuff for IM epi, but when we're talking about IV epi for anaphylaxis, this is totally empirical. We're just kind of making our best guess based on the situation in front of us. I would say for adults, you want to start with 5 to 10 mic boluses up to about 200 mics total. For pediatric dosing, again, 0.1 mics per kilo up to about 3 mics per kilo total. Another thing that I think that will help you out in this situation, again, because oral surgeons are working alone in an office with perhaps very little help and maybe no other providers, is how do you actually mix that epi up? So I think the best way to do that is to take that 1 mg per milliliter, that little vial with the purple top, and to open that up, pull out the entire cc and shoot it in a 1-liter bag. So what you're doing with that is you're making baby epi. So that concentration is then going to be 1 mic per cc. And when you have 1 mic per cc, now you're a lot less likely to overdose this patient. Because if you push 10 cc's, you're just giving him 10 mics. You're not like flooding them with epi. So I think especially in an emergency situation, that's a quick and dirty way to do it so that you can make sure that those doses are still small. Even if you push a 20 cc syringe or 20 mics, that's likely not going to cause irreparable damage to an adult.
It sounds like in our setting where we're rarely pushing epi IV, because trying to figure all that out and the calculations in an emergency, it seems pretty stressful, man.
It's incredibly stressful. And I love that. I think that the last allergy podcast, I think that what he did was IM to the thigh. And I think that I love that, especially in that like office-based setting, because that IM is going to almost act like an infusion, right? It's not going to come on and come off so quick. It's going to hit in about 8 to 10 minutes. And then it's also going to provide you a little bit of that residual, which is certainly nice when your hands are tied and you don't have a ton of help. The other thing I will talk about is we can just touch on glucagon. So glucagon does reverse a beta blockade in those patients that are the epi doesn't work on. Again, that's about 10% of patients, but glucagon is very emetogenic, so it's going to cause the patient to vomit. And I don't think that's probably the best idea when you potentially have already a difficult airway. So I probably personally, I've never pushed glucagon myself. I wouldn't have that in my algorithm.
Real quick, going back to the epi IM injection, if you don't have the auto injector and you know you're just using the vial, so you're saying, and there's 1 milligram in the vial, basically we pull up half of that in like a syringe and maybe a ketamine syringe or something you can inject with, and then just give them 500 mics in the thigh.
That's perfect. What you're probably looking for is your blue tip needle, which should be 15 millimeters. And that's actually the same depth as an EpiPen. An EpiPen is going to go in 15.2 millimeters. So that's probably the perfect depth for most patients, if they're very, very large, maybe something longer. But yes, exactly. And you want to use for IM, you want to use that 1 in 100,000 concentration, which is 1 milligram per milliliter. So you'd pull up a half cc of 1 milligram per milliliter, which is 500 mics, and you'd go right into the anterolateral thigh.
Got it. That makes sense.
Yeah. No, great question. The other thing is fluid. So again, two mainstays of treatment, two drugs. I like to call fluid a drug because it is. Epi, and we talked about epi, and now fluids. So during anaphylaxis, about 40% of the blood volume can extravasate out of the vascular bed. And some data shows that up to 75% of the blood volume can be lost within 15 minutes. So for that, you're going to want to use aggressive fluid administration. For adult dosing, I would say that 1 to 2 liter bolus is appropriate, 1.5 liters bolus. And then for pediatrics, you want to use 20 milliliters per kilogram. And then if you're in that situation where the patient's not super responsive, or what we call non-responsive to epi, the adult dosing would be 2 to 4 liters. In some cases in the ER literature, it's up to 8 liters until the patient really starts to turn the corner. So we're talking like absurd, massive amounts of fluid resuscitation. In a pediatric patient that's non-responsive to epi, up to 50 milliliters per kilogram. So these are very, very high doses. And then we kind of touched on this earlier, but steroids and antihistamines, put them on the back burner. They're not going to hurt your patient, but they're certainly not going to save your patient in an acute setting. You know, I always go back to, you guys are all alone in an office with perhaps very minimal help. So put those last. There's one doc on a podcast that said, antihistamines, if you give antihistamines, you're helping their itch while they're dying. You know, I just thought that was kind of an interesting way to put it. So yeah, that kind of should come last.
Good point.
There is perhaps a role for bronchodilators like albuterol, but you know, I think that if you're giving epi, you're already probably hitting your betas sufficiently. And then following the episode, and this is more of kind of like just full circle, like 30,000 foot view, is there is such thing as a biphasic reaction with anaphylaxis, where you're going to have a recrudescence, or this is going to have anaphylaxis that secondary onset after the initial presentation. The old literature said it happened about in 20% of cases. I think the new literature is pointing to about 4% of cases. So this doesn't happen too often. It happens on a median time frame of 8 to 12 hours following the initial, but it can occur from 1 to 3 days. following the initial presentation. I don't think the literature is too clear on why this is happening. Some are saying because there's reperfusion to tissues, which is carrying histamine back into circulation. But it is more likely for certain individuals, and those individuals are as follows. If your trigger was unknown initially, if your initial presentation was hypotension, or if you had a severe reaction initially. So I think like from the ED literature, they're always talking about, well, how long do you hold these patients for? And there's no guidelines on this. I think that most ED docs would hold for at least 6 hours. That's kind of the standard. But if the patient had one round of epi and is completely resolving, that's a patient that probably can be sent home with some EpiPens and do just fine. Whereas the more severe patients that had maybe 2 rounds of IM epi and an epi drip are probably going to be a lot slower to improve. And they may be somebody that you want to watch for a longer period of time.
For the patient in the dental office or the oral surgery office, who has what we think is anaphylaxis, we pushed epi, they recover, they seem like they're doing fine. I mean, do you recommend they just routinely call EMS and transport them, or you send them over to the hospital, or what would you say?
Yeah, so that's super tough. So I will say that like guidelines have, so the old guidelines like that allergists used to say to people is that if you use epi and you think it's anaphylaxis, you just bought yourself an ambulance trip to the ED, right? But then COVID came along and the ED was full of COVID patients. So they kind of changed their thinking on this. And what they told patients is, well, if you had an anaphylaxis, you used an EpiPen, you resolved very quickly, and you are feeling completely fine, then you do not necessarily need to come to the ED. So what I would say is, I mean, like if you want to be very safe and doing things probably by the book, is if you're giving epi for anaphylaxis, I would say yes, you probably bought yourself a transport to the ED for that patient. However, I think based on the literature, if the patient was completely resolved, you gave IM epi, maybe there's a case where you could send them to their PCP right afterwards. But I think that there's, God forbid there's a, you know, a biphasic reaction or something like that, I would just want a second set of eyes to keep an eye on that patient, make sure that nothing was missed. And if you send them to the ED, you can hopefully assure that they're going to walk out of there with an EpiPen, which if it's their first time, that's definitely what they should have.
Okay. And then another question I have, I mean, this is a whole probably different topic, but because I think most of us in oral surgery, we're taking out third molars and we're prescribing them post-op antibiotics. You know, we're not giving them pre-op, although a lot do. But the whole topic of the patient having an anaphylaxis at home or stuff like that, how do you prevent that? How do you coach them if they do call and they're like, gosh, I'm having all these issues? How do you deal with all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's such a very real topic. I think that education is the key. There's, especially in the pediatric literature, like a lot of ED visits, and I can't remember the percentages, are due to like antibiotics. And obviously, we've talked on this podcast, my friend Dr. Dave Solomon talked about antibiotic stewardship. So I think that, yes, it is a potential allergen and a trigger for anaphylaxis. So maybe we should just be more diligent about coaching our patients that this antibiotic that I'm giving you could potentially cause an allergic reaction. If you are feeling, and kind of go back to that diagnostic criteria, if you are feeling a scratchy throat, or if you have a rash and you're having some trouble breathing, this is, you need to call 911.
Yeah, I think that's a good, I mean, one-liner to throw on your pre-op instructions when we're talking to the patient. Because I think most of us will say, yeah, by the way, we're prescribing you a pain pill, you know, an antibiotic, a mouth rinse. But then it's so easy just to follow up with, and by the way, if you start getting hives or, you know, whatever, lightheaded and all this stuff, immediately get attention for this.
Yeah. These types of allergic reactions are on the rise. If you look at the statistics, that more people than ever are becoming allergic and having anaphylactic reactions. Luckily, the fatality rates have not increased, but the number of people actually having anaphylaxis in the US is increasing. So who knows what the cause of that is, but it is more and more probable for sure. We can certainly talk about some other questions if you have any. I think that if we were to review kind of like what the takeaways are from today, is under anesthesia, if you have unexplained hypotension, especially in an office-based setting with ASA ones and twos, pretty healthy people, think about anaphylaxis and don't necessarily look for those skin signs. Look for that triad, which is hypotension first, bronchospasm, and tachycardia. Remember that the mainstays of treatment are epi and fluids, kind of forget about the rest until later on. And then obviously oxygen and airway. And then especially, you know, if a patient's in the office-based setting, consider IM epi, even if you have IV access. So again, like back to the ED docs, they're fully lined up. They have IV access, but they're still going IM. So, you know, if you're in an operating room and you have more help and you have more hands free and you have done a lot of IV epi, I think that is for anesthesiologists, they're always going to go IV, but we're kind of this hybrid between both parties, I think.
And just to add to that, I mean, I think prepping and making sure you each day you're checking your crash cart, you have the epi, you know, the concentrations. If that means you have a card in there that's laminated that shows you anything to prepare for making this a stress-free setting to give the right dose. And then I liked what you were saying with the risk factors of people that should be raising a red flag in your mind, like this guy has a high chance of having this, you know, who has asthma, either African-American, you know, obese, all, like those things should be kind of tipping us off and we should be more alert and aware that this could be happening.
Absolutely. And like, I remember listening to a previous podcast and I think it was you that said, like, you have like every emergency and like that little drug in the box. So it's like you find out what the emergency is and then you have your drugs right there and you maybe have a flashcard to kind of cheat sheet you through how to use that drug. I think that's brilliant.
Yep, exactly. Well, I think this has been a fantastic review of anaphylaxis. I really like what you're talking about and the KISS principle, keep it simple. And I think takeaway for me is hypotension is probably what we're seeing first. And IM epi, given that right dose and stuff like that. So a lot of good information. If there are listeners who have further questions, are you cool if I put your contact info in the show notes for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Send it over.
Sounds good. And then we can't end this podcast without some rapid fire questions.
Oh boy. Okay.
What is the best book you've read in the past year?
I'm going to give two. So Mountains Beyond Mountains is a book that I'm almost finished. It's about Dr. Paul Farmer. He did a lot of work with TB and AIDS in Haiti. That's a great read for anybody in medicine. Probably the other one is Unbroken, which is about a POW in World War II named Louis Zamperini. And it's about his like crazy journey from getting shot down in the Pacific on a raft for 40 something days and then like in a concentration camp. So there's a great survivor story. Yes, probably those two.
Yes. I haven't read Mountains Beyond Mountains, but Unbroken is one of my favorite stories. Just incredible.
Yeah, it's great.
What non-dental anesthesiology thing do you do each day that helps you with your daily skills?
So I haven't had time to do this recently, but I used to paint a fair amount. So it kept the, you know, the hand skills good, I think.
Nice.
You see behind me.
Yeah, I like that. Can chill you out and give you those Bob Ross vibes and just
more
inner peace.
I love it.
That's great. Okay. Favorite movie you've seen in the last year or TV series?
So there's this TV series that I feel like not a lot of people have heard about. It's called Severance, which, gosh, I forget what platform it's on, but it's a wild concept where when you go into work, your brain disconnect so you don't remember your outside work self from your inside work self. And it's just a very unique concept. Great writing. So that one was pretty wild. And then for movie, I know it's like a little outdated now, but Top Gun Maverick was awesome.
Oh, great. That was fantastic. And then how about favorite quote? Do you have a favorite quote or a saying that you like?
So I'll give two. For anesthesia. So the first one is slow is fast and fast is slow. The person who quoted this shall remain nameless, but he will know who he is. And so what that means is kind of like, if you try to rush things and skip steps in your setup, you're going to eventually have to go back and kind of correct those errors. So be slow and be methodical in your setup, and then you will be able to work fast.
I like that.
Yeah, I love that one. And the second is the first rule of anesthesia is trust no one. And the second rule of anesthesia is like the second rule of Fight Club. It's the same as the first.
Oh, man, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in our setting, probably that kicks in with like who's pulling up your drugs and who's keeping your drugs and just like making sure that you're supervising all that and knowing for sure what's happening, as opposed to just letting people do stuff for you and you're trusting that it's all going right.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you've talked about this in previous episodes of like the oxygen setup and verifying every single day. I mean, this is all like stuff that sometimes I think is taken for granted, but that's everything. That's awesome.
Yes, 100%. All right, John. Well, thank you so much. This has been really good for me, and I think our listeners will benefit a lot from this discussion. Really appreciate it. Love to talk to you again on the podcast sometime.
Sounds great. It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Sounds good. Have a good rest of the day.
You too. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.